Welcome to Necessary Conversations with Daryl M. Taliaferro. Conversations that are real, raw, and relevant. Let's get the conversation started now.
Hey, welcome to episode number 7 of Necessary Conversations. Hey, I'm excited about today's episode because this is part 2 of the injustice of the justice system. Now listen, I'm joined again by my friend, Keita Haynes. She is the senior legal advisor at Free Hearts, which is a nonprofit organization led by formerly incarcerated women. Keita Haynes, what's happening?
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Listen, we are in part 2. Part 1 was phenomenal, but part 2, we're really going to dig deep and really talk about some things. You ready?
Yep, I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right, so part 1, we heard your story, mm-hmm. and we heard about how you were affected by the injustice that you did not benefit from. But now, I want to talk about Trayvon Martin. I want to talk about Breonna Taylor, and we want to weave a story together. But before we do that, I want to bring to light the fact that in hearing your story, you were one that needed to be represented mm-hmm. by someone who was credible, someone who was knowledgeable. But once you went to school, you got your piece of paper, you now became that representation. Mm-hmm. You became that person that represented individuals who were not able to represent themselves or what some would view as the disenfranchised. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So working at the public defender's office, that's, you know, we represented people who could not afford to hire their own attorneys. And so most of my clients were Black and brown and from low income communities. And, you know, the way that you look at it, it's the people in our communities that are considered the least of these, the ones who are forgotten, the ones who, you know, no one listens to, whose voices are not amplified or centered. And so that was the population of people that I was representing, the population of people that find themselves in, you know, a cycle of poverty, you know, the ones that are living in neighborhoods that are over-policed, and the ones that I just feel like that we have failed in society when it comes to them. So that was, you know, my clients and their families and the community. And mm-hmm. I loved my clients, loved working with them, loved getting to know them. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we think that being, you know, Black and, you know, being a female, you know, that, you know, to some degree, we understand what people are dealing with and what people are going through. But I found myself a lot of times having to really acknowledge that I didn't, wow. You know, to a certain degree, yes, but also to, you know, to another degree, I didn't. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know what it's like to have to decide whether I am going to pay my insurance on my car or whether I'm going to put food on my table for my kids.
Right.
I didn't know what it was like, you know, to want to get off of heroin, but because you don't have the necessary insurance to go to treatment, that you use what you consider a lesser drug, which is cocaine, in order to step yourself off of heroin. You know, like mm-hmm. I didn't know what that was like. I didn't know what it was like to, you know, not have a valid driver's license and still trying to go to work and still trying to provide, you know, for my family right. and being pulled over, you know, by the police. And like I said, and just being stuck in this, you know, perpetual cycle of poverty that the criminal justice system, you know, that's what it perpetuates. And, you know, and so as much as I can say, I understood about the criminal justice system. But just things that bring people into the criminal justice system. No, it was the most humbling job, you know, that I have ever had.
Yeah. And it's interesting because ultimately, quite often for those of us who are outside looking in, we feel that we understand, oh, well, they're going through this or they're going through that. But it's not until you really work with these individuals on a one-on-one basis mm-hmm. that you really understand that their plight is different than our plight
or
their circumstance is different than our circumstance.
Well, and I mean, and not even that, but it's, you know, like I said, it was humbling because of that. But it was humbling because you stop and you literally like say, you know what, this could be me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, and that's the, you know, like that's the humbling part, you know, like, I found myself like, you know, the Mary Mary song, like, you know, like it literally came to life. Mm-hmm. Like everything, you know, I'm saying that they sing about, you know, and I'm looking at my clients. It's just like, you know, this could have been me. I remember having a client and he would appear to be homeless. A lot of times people appear to be homeless. We're not. Right. And he would appear to be homeless. You know, black man, you know, it was very interesting because, you know, we see people and, you know, and I mean, like, it's just the world that we live in, you know, like we create these stereotypes in our minds. And like I said, he appeared to be homeless. And so, you know, I'm talking to him, we're talking about his situation. You know, he had a drug problem and we were talking about, you know, getting him some help. And so we were in the back where they, you know, keep, you know, our clients and stuff. And so I came out, you know, into the courtroom and there was this, you know, family there. And, you know, they asked if I was, you know, Miss Haynes. And I said, yeah. And so they told me that they were the family of this guy
right
back in the back. And I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
It was his mom, his dad, his sister.
Right.
And they were in there dressed to the nines.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like just everything, just like a stark contrast to what he was.
Right.
You know, back there, whatever. And, mm-hmm. you know, and they, you know, explained that, you know, he has mental health issues. He's got, you know, addiction issues and they've been trying to get him help and stuff. You know, and really, you know, like wanted to get him help. But it was just so interesting that, you know, we really think that we know people. And then, you know, I'm talking to him and, you know, I mean, life will definitely age you.
Yes.
And so, you know, I'm talking to him and I'm writing down some notes and I asked him how old he was. And when he told me how old he was, I put my pencil down and stopped writing because this man was the exact same age that I was.
Wow.
And he looked like 10 years older just because, you know, life happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so it's just, you know, just unbelievable, you know, like, you know, just in those moments, you know, I mean, like there were so many times that I was reminded, like, this could be me. You know, it was just, you know, like I said, it was just so interesting. You know, when you would hear the stories and for me, you know, like I would really have to stop and would really be listening and really engaged because, again, like so many times, like I would just be like, my gosh, like, you know, like this could be me. But, you know, particularly with her, because, you know, she was a single mom. She had a few kids, you know, just trying to make it. Yeah. And here we are bringing her into the courtroom to waive fees and fines so that she can legally drive her car to go to work to support her kids. And, you know, and it's just like, this is crazy. Like, what are we doing to people?
Yeah.
You know, like what are we really doing? Had another female, she had a couple of kids. She was supposed to take a driver's license class. You know, she didn't have the $80 to pay for the class. And, you know, and I felt so bad for her because, you know, people are having to come into this courtroom. People are having to lay bare, you know, their entire lives in front of these judges, only for these judges to not have any type of empathy whatsoever, to continue to dehumanize them. And this girl is saying, you know, she has a couple of kids. You know, she was working at McDonald's. She's homeless. She had a 6-month-old baby. Her and her kids are sleeping in her car, but wow. Yet the judge is yelling at her because she didn't pay the $80 to go to a driving class. And I'm just like, did you not hear this lady say that she just had a 6-month-old baby and her other 3 kids are sleeping in her car and she's working at McDonald's trying to find a place to stay so that they don't have to continue to sleep in her car because it's about to be cold outside. And we're talking about $80. Like,
right.
I mean, like, it's just, you know, it's just unbelievable. Like, you know, the you know, some of the things that people are dealing with that we're just not aware of.
It shows the great disconnect between sometimes people of influence and those who are perceived to have none.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even when you consider the gentleman earlier that you referenced, there's a difference between being homeless and being houseless.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he did not have a house to go to per se, he had a home. He had family who were mm-hmm. willing to accept him. But then there are certain individuals either who are on the street by choice or based upon situations that put them there.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless as to what their condition is, whether it be by choice or be by force or whatever the situation, it still does not give the justice system a right to treat them less than second-class citizens.
We all deserve to be treated with dignity and respect.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that is one of the things that I find that is, you know, particularly lacking, you know, in the criminal justice system is, you know, recognizing that these are human beings here and that they deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. And not all judges, you know, there are some that, you know, that do go out of their way to treat people with dignity and respect. And then there are some that absolutely could care less.
Yeah. So I want us to now go on this journey. Mm-hmm. I want you to speak from both one who has sat in the seat to be represented,
mm-hmm.
and then one who also has stood to represent. All right. So we're going to talk now about Trayvon Martin. And I want us to go back to the night of February 26, 2012, when Trayvon Martin was just simply walking back to his father's fiance's house.
Mm-hmm.
And as he was walking to his father's fiance's house, here this gentleman by the name of George Zimmerman approaches him. He is the neighborhood watch guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he, for whatever reason, I wasn't there. Apparently, there are no audio accounts of this event, no true video accounts of this event.
Mm-hmm.
From what we know, he approached Trayvon. They got into some sort of tussle. It concluded in Trayvon Martin having a wound to the chest and he dying.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is. Trayvon Martin is dead. George Zimmerman goes free. Simply because of what Florida calls the Stand Your Ground law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we weren't there. There are no witnesses. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do know is that when he called the police to report the incident regarding Trayvon, the police told him, don't pursue. But he did it anyway. How is it that a white man, the watch guy, can go hunt, pursue, and kill an unarmed black man with no recourse? How is it that Trayvon Martin, minding his own business, walking back from the convenience store with Skittles in his hand and iced tea in his hand, on his way back to his father's fiance, is gunned down simply for walking in a neighborhood? How is that possible? Well, I'll tell you how it's possible. I believe that it's because Trayvon Martin was the wrong color. And George Zimmerman allegedly was the right color. We have an injustice system. I mean, what do you think?
You know, I think the issue speaks to, you know, the criminalization of black people. You know, where we see black kids and we automatically assume that black kids are violent.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you can look at any, you know, of the situations, you know, not just with Trayvon, but with, you know, Tamar, you know, and, you know, Elijah McCain, you know, more recently,
sure.
You know, it's just, it's the criminalization of black people. And I think, you know, that is where the problem lies, is that people that, you know, we're criminalized just for being black.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, there's a host of other, you know, consequences that come, you know, with that mentality of criminalizing people because they're black. And so, you know, when, you know, we just think of like criminals, and it's just like, oh, well, we've got to protect ourselves against criminals.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, and so here, you know, here we are, you know, in this situation where, you know, that's what we have, is that, you know, we are, you know, saying, hey, you know, these people are bad simply because they're black,
mm-hmm.
and we need to protect ourselves against them.
Yeah.
And that's where we were, you know, in 2012. And that's where we still are now in 2020. You know, even, you know, with just with Jacob Blake.
Right.
You know, the police didn't know who he was when they were, you know, pursuing him. They didn't know that he had, you know, an outstanding warrant. They didn't even know that there was even a knife in the car. It was just a simple fact that this was a black man.
Yeah, because ultimately, the police were on the scene not for him.
Exactly.
The police were on the scene because allegedly two white women were fighting.
And how he gets involved is that he was trying to break up the fight. Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now the attention is on him as a black man.
Exactly. Instead of the reason why they were called out, you know, there to begin with, you know, it wasn't as if like they was just like, hey, you know, let me see your, you know what I'm saying, your ID, and they go and run it and see that he has this warrant, and then they're pursuing him. Like, no, that's not how it happened.
But, you know, even that, I find great problem and difficulty understanding. And again, let me give this disclaimer. I've said this on a previous episode. I am not a police officer. You know, I've never been. However, I still find it difficult to understand. You have this random person that's there. They have not presented an issue in front of you, nor has anyone said that they were an issue when you showed up to the scene. Why even ask them for the ID, or why even try to entertain them in that way to shift the narrative from the problem and now make it a problem with somebody else?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's it's unfortunate. And I mean, you know, I'm not a police officer. I've never been a police officer. Have never, you know, outside of being a public defender, never worked with, you know, police officers. Mm-hmm. But I will say, and I mean, and, you know, and I'm not going to be somebody that says, you know, like it's all police officers, because, right, you know, I don't think so either. But I mean, I think, you know, we have to look at, you know, the history of policing and why policing, you know, began to begin with. You know, it was to keep black people in line.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, and that's the thing. And so like the, you know, while policing has evolved, like the purpose of it has not.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's the thing. And so, you know, we can, you know, create, you know, have all kinds of training and everything, you know what I'm saying, for these police officers. And that's great. You know, I'm not opposed to that. But I mean, but let's really get to the root of the problem, and let's reimagine, you know, what policing is and what the purpose of policing is.
But, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, and I'm glad you do, because ultimately, when you think about the injustice of the justice system, you can't really deal with the injustice of the justice system without dealing with the injustice of the whole country. I mean, even as this country was founded, it was founded upon land that we did not settle upon. Other settlers were here, and we stole the land from them and consequently built what we call the home of the free, the home of the brave. We steal land, and we perpetuate this narrative that we are the greatest country in the world. But we have done an injustice to those who were here before us. We then go throughout history, and then we have restricted African Americans, then called Negroes, then called colored, then called darkies and black people. And then we want to still be the home of the free and the home of the brave. The unfortunate reality is that the injustice did not start with the justice system. It started way back in 1492, specifically October 12th, 1492, when Columbus allegedly founded America. But we all know that's not the truth. He came here and he stole land that was already occupied by those who were here before us. And we claimed it as our own. And that same spirit moved from centuries and years, even into slavery and chattel slavery. And then we now have injustice that is still among us in the year 2020. So the injustice of the justice system is real. So it didn't just start with police officers. It just didn't start in the courtroom, but it started in the field. It started on the boat, and it started way back when, and it's still happening even right now.
Like I said, there's enough blame to go around. I mean, you know, we can't, you know, have conversations about police accountability without having conversations about prosecutorial misconduct.
Of course.
You know, we can't have conversations about police accountability, you know, without talking about the judges that are sitting on the bench, without talking about, you know, the probation system, you know, without talking about, you know, the parole system, the pardon system, the governor, you know. So, I mean, you know, all of these things are connected. And so, you know, we can't talk about, you know, and that's why I tell people there's so much when it comes to criminal justice reform.
Yeah.
It's not just one thing. It's not just, you know, people are talking about criminal justice reform now because, you know, now it's police accountability. But, you know, there's so much more, you know, to criminal justice reform. And because there's so much to it, you can't just say, oh, well, we're going to focus on this piece of it and then don't deal with the rest of it. You know, you have to deal with the rest of it because, you know, we have, you know, like, for instance, you know, in Breonna Taylor's case. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got the police officers that, you know, that went, you know, to serve this no-knock warrant at this house on, you know, some faulty information. But then we also have, you know what I'm saying, where the officers that, you know what I'm saying, that were reckless have not even been, you know, arrested or anything in this particular case. And so this is where, you know, it comes down to, you know, we have to start looking at the DAs as well, too, in this situation. Like, you know, it's I think like the last thing I saw that said that they were presenting the case to the grand jury.
That's correct.
You know, and it's just like, well, I mean, we all know that you don't have to present a case to the grand jury. Like, you know, they can just indict a case all on their own. It doesn't have to go through the grand jury process.
Right.
But, you know, it's just a way, you know, for, you know, Daniel Cameron to say, oh, well, I did my job.
Of course it is.
You know, but that's not true. And, you know, and so that just goes to show that there are so many different layers to this thing when it comes to, you know, criminal justice reform.
But here's the problem. And the problem for me is that as an average citizen, so to speak, mm-hmm. as one who is not an attorney, that one who is not familiar with the court system, other than having had to sit in the court several times, you know, with, you know, individuals that I may have been there to vouch for or whatever. It's interesting how, as a practicing attorney, you know, the minutia and the crap that goes on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how, and I'm just going to be real, how this BS is causing us as African-Americans to be negatively affected.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody wants to really bring that to light. No one really wants to say it. No one really wants to pull back the cover and say, hey, this is the big problem here.
Mm-hmm.
For example, with Daniel Cameron, he is a Republican. He is one who recently Donald Trump just said that he would consider him one of 20 people to be on the Supreme Court if he's reelected.
Mm-hmm.
Now, listen, I believe wholeheartedly that the two issues, the issue with Donald Trump saying, hey, yeah, I would consider Daniel Cameron, and the issue with Breonna Taylor are not mutually exclusive. They're not.
Well, I mean, it's not even just Donald Trump. I mean, like, you know, like the man worked for Mitch McConnell.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
and learn from him.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. You know, so, I mean, you know, there are so many layers, you know, to him. And again, to that particular situation there. And, you know, we just, you know, we all saw today where, you know, they're, you know, settling for $12 million. But, you know, that's not justice.
Right.
You know, like, you know, that's great that, you know, her family, you know, will be compensated. But Breonna is never coming back. No amount of money is ever going to bring her back.
Right.
And, you know, and the thing is that they have not, again, these police officers have not been arrested. So who's being held accountable? They're just giving them money and saying, please go away.
Right.
No one is being held accountable in this situation. And then the thing is that it's not even the police officers that's ever going to have to pay this money. You know, this money is coming from the state.
Yeah.
So again, you know, there's, you know, there's no accountability here, you know, when it comes to this. And I mean, and like I said, you know, I'm not part of her family. You know, I don't know how they feel, you know, about this settlement. But again, you know, I just feel like that this is like hush money. This is just like, we'll give you this and you guys go away.
You're absolutely right. But here's the interesting thing. Breonna Taylor was an EMT. She was a representative of the city.
Mm-hmm.
If as a representative of the city, a public official, a public officer, so to speak, is in this situation where she's gunned down recklessly in a sense of, uh-oh, we made a mistake. Imagine somebody who has no title. Imagine somebody who has no name. Imagine someone who has no affluence in the community. If they don't care about her, you know they don't care about Pookie and Nene on the street.
Mm-mm, they do not. And I mean, and again, you know, I'm just like, you know, like I said, with the situation that we had here, you know, thank God that, you know, it didn't turn out worse because, I mean, again, the same thing happened with Miss Hines.
Sure.
Where they go to her house, you know what I'm saying, to serve this warrant, to looking for somebody that doesn't live there, you know, with these guns drawn, banging on her door, knocking it in and stuff like that or whatever, you know. And had it not been for the fact that these officers had on body cam footage, we would never know that this happened. But the question is that how many times has this happened and we've never heard about it?
You know what? Excellent point.
A lot of times these things happen and we don't hear about it. Yeah. And nobody, you know what I'm saying? Nobody says anything about it. And, you know, and the police get to continue on doing, you know what I'm saying, what they've been doing, terrorizing people and traumatizing people, you know, for years. I mean, like I had a client and the police officer strip searched him on the side of the road.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's just flat out ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the deal. None of us want to be in a situation that we've done wrong and we're exposed. None of us. However, as a public official, as one who has taken an oath of office, it is your responsibility to offer up some level of transparency.
Mm-hmm.
Even to say, hey, you know what? My team dropped the ball. I can respect an officer who owns up to their mistake far more than I can respect an officer who doesn't.
Right.
If the officer said, you know what, we had misleading information, it was our fault, we made the mistake. Honestly, I would not call for the arrest of the officers if they did that. If they were forthright in that, I would not call for the arrest. Would I call for them to be fired? Yes. Would I call for them to have some other disciplinary actions? Yes. But to be arrested? No. If they owned up to the issue, what my problem now becomes, they also tried to cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
They also tried to make it seem like there was drugs in the residence. There were no drugs found. Neither Breonna Taylor or her boyfriend had a record.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's when you talk about the injustice of the justice system,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's ridiculous because you can literally, Keita, be driving down the street,
mm-hmm.
minding your own business, and you, as attorney Keita Haynes, can be pulled over. The police officer, not knowing who you are,
mm-hmm.
can give you the third degree until yep. you open your mouth and give them back the law.
Mm-hmm.
And even at that, as a Black woman, you still may have issue because they're going to feel like you're being smart to them.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. definitely me as a Black man, I exactly. better not say nothing.
Right. And that's the thing is that, you know, because we were having conversations and, you know, talking about, you know, the search for the new police chief and, you know, the community oversight board and even, you know, like the mayor's commission on policing. And, you know, and some people made the comments. So it's like, oh, you know, like, I don't care about criminal justice reform. Like, it doesn't have anything to do with me. Like, I'm not committing any crimes. And I'm just like, yeah, but like, but don't you understand this, that you don't even have to commit any crimes? And like, and you should care about, you know, like the criminal justice system. You should care about, you know, who our next police chief is going to be
yeah.
Here, you know, in Nashville. You should care about the policies and procedures that are in place, you know, at the police department, you know, that, you know, has led to so much, you know, injustice, you know, in our communities. Like, you know, everybody should care about those things because you don't have to live in certain areas and certain neighborhoods in order to be subjected, you know, to this type of behavior. You're Black and that's green light enough, you know, and yeah. it's, you know, and it's so hard to get people to understand that because people say, oh, well, I put my hands on the steering wheel, you know what I'm saying? When I get pulled over, I say yes, sir, no, sir, to police officers and stuff like that. And I mean, and if that's what you choose to do, then that's what you choose to do. But I mean, but that's still not any guarantee that this situation is going to go left real quick, simply because you are Black.
Listen, I have a friend who is a police chaplain in a city. And in that city, the police chaplains can drive an unmarked police car. I should say it's a police car, but it doesn't have like actually the lights and the sirens.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But it does say, I think, the name of the city, and it says police chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend was driving the police car around at night, and he gets pulled over in the police car. And the police say, oh, we thought the car was stolen. Now, wait a minute. How do you think that the car is stolen? And one, I failed to mention, my friend had on the chaplain's uniform that they wear. Why of all the cars would someone want to steal a chaplain's car? If I'm going to steal a police car, I'm going to steal one with lights and sirens if it were me. So my point in that is, you don't even have to be a regular citizen. You could be a person that's even working with law enforcement. It's mm-hmm. just because the color of your skin that there is a level of intimidation. So let me ask you this. If somebody was affected by the injustice of the justice system, what would you advise them? What should they do?
Well, I mean, it really depends. I mean, the good thing is that here in Nashville, you know, we have the Community Oversight Board now.
Yeah.
And so the good thing is that people can file complaints with the Community Oversight Board and, you know, and really have them do an independent investigation separate from anything that Metro is doing, you know, regarding a case. And so that's the good thing. And it's something that I think that, you know, should be implemented all across, you know, the United States. You know, every city should have community oversight boards, and community oversight boards should actually, you know, they should absolutely have subpoena powers in order for them to be able to do, you know, the work that they need to do effectively.
Sure.
And so, you know, that's, you know, the good thing about it. You know, also too, just depending on, you know, the level of the injustice, you know, some people do hire civil attorneys, you know, to bring, you know, to actually file, you know, civil rights lawsuits and stuff, you know, against the police departments and cities and stuff like that. You know, but I think that, you know, the best thing that we can do is that, you know, we all can, you know, continue to shed light on what is going on in the criminal justice system and demand that, you know, that our elected officials create policies and procedures, you know, in order to change these things and, you know, and to hold them accountable and to hold, you know, the judges accountable, the DAs accountable, you know, and all of those things. And for those that are not in Nashville, I would say, you know, like start advocating, you know, for a community oversight board and start advocating, you know, for change, you know, in the community. Because the thing is that it takes all of us, you know, uplifting our collective voices together around these issues, because it's not just the one person that has been impacted. It, you know, this impacts each and every single one of us. And so, you know, in situations like this, we need to stand together with the people and the families that have been impacted and, you know, and uplift their voices, you know, in these times and, you know, and moving forward and demand change, you know, for them and for, you know, for our communities, because, you know, these things are, you know, systemic. It's not something that is just like, you know, a little isolated incident here or there, you know, like you know, we're at a point where, you know, it's like a reckoning. And so, you know, we've got to, you know, acknowledge, you know, our 400 plus years, you know what I'm saying, of slavery, what we've done to Black people, you know, and the policies and procedures that have been, you know, put into place, you know, that are still directly impacting us to this very day. Like, we have to acknowledge that and, you know, and hold the people accountable that have, you know, that have worked to keep, you know, these systems of white supremacy in place.
Yeah. So listen, just as we review, you know, if people are experiencing injustice or if they feel as if, you know, I've been treated unfairly by the justice system, here's what you need to do. And these are not in any particular order. First of all, you need to assess how you feel. You need to make sure that what you feel is laced in fact. You need to be sure that what you feel is not predicated upon emotion. It's important that if your city has a community oversight board, that you contact them immediately so that there is a fair and objective, non-biased assessment of your situation. But then the other thing is you potentially may need to hire an attorney. Don't assume that you know more about your situation than an attorney. You may need to provide yourself with legal representation, someone who is knowledgeable about the law, someone who is knowledgeable about various cases similar to yours that can help you see the case from a different perspective. But beyond that, as a voter, as a citizen, as a community member, we've got to hold our elected officials accountable. We've got to do it because if we don't do it, nobody will.
Thanks for listening to Necessary Conversations with Daryl M. Taliaferro. Follow us on social media at Necessary Conversations Podcast. Join the conversation by leaving a message on our website, necessaryconversationspodcast.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you'll be notified every time a new one drops. Now, go have the conversations you need to have with the people you need to have them with.